Many people start their careers in Hollywood in talent agencies. Shep Gordon started his in a roadside motel while he was high on acid. It got punched in the mouth by Janis Joplin. As it turns out, this initiation into the business was just a sign of the random circumstances that would come. In a book called They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll, Mr. Gordon shares this and other colorful stories about the many decades he had as a manager, agent, and producer to bands and stars like Alice Cooper, Blondie, Groucho Marx. It is published by the Anthony Bourdain imprint at Echo, and I'm very pleased to welcome Shep Gordon back to our show.
Thanks for having me back. Nice to be here.
And that Anthony Bourdain connection is significant. We'll get to that later. Yeah. So on your second day in California, Janis Joplin punched you in the mouth.
Yes.
Why and how did that happen?
I came out to California, worked for one day at Los Padrinos Juvenile Hall as a probation officer. I was a sociology major, and there weren't many professions. And it didn't work out well. I sort of got beat up a little bit there the first day and checked into a motel and took some psychedelics, which is what children did in those days.
I just have to keep in mind that the FCC has certain rules. Certain words can't be said.
Yes. And heard someone screaming down at the pool. Because I had come from a jail, I thought of rape and separated them, and the girl punched me. In fact, they were making love. And then in the morning, I went down to the pool with Janis Joplin.
Now, this was at the Landmark, that was kind of like the Chelsea Hotel of Los Angeles. A lot of rock stars stayed there.
Yeah, a lot of rock stars. It's actually where Janis ended up dying a couple of years later. But it, when I was there, and I lived there also for the next few years, but the Chambers Brothers stayed there a lot. Jimi Hendrix stayed there a lot. Paul Rothschild, who produced Jim Morrison, was there. People came and went.
And this is when they were famous.
Yes, but fame was a very different thing then. You know, in those days, you headlined a place like Madison Square Garden. It was a $2 ticket. So the scale of economics was completely different. They were well known and had a certain amount of celebrity, but, you know, with the Rolling Stone crowd, and they were still hitchhiking.
But you slipped into management in an unconventional way, or were other people also doing it the same way? You started by selling them drugs.
Right. And at one point...
Is the statute of limitations up on this?
I hope so. And at one point, the Chambers brother said to me, they were sitting with Jimmy, and they said, how are you going to explain how you pay for your room if the police ask you? And I said, in my life as a middle-class Jewish kid, nobody asks. And they said, well, you better get a story. Are you Jewish? And I said, yes. My partner and I, Joey Greenberg at the time, said, yeah, we're Jewish. And they said, you should be managers. And they introduced us to Alice Cooper, who I still manage 47 years later.
At that time, Alice Cooper meant the band, the guy.
Meant the band. Alice says, we met on a lie. They told us they were singers and musicians, and I told them I was a manager.
And they were already known for their crazy stage antics and their unconventional music, we might say, at the time. Were you a fan of what they were doing?
No, not at all, which was a positive part of the campaign, because I wouldn't have to do any work. They were a front for my pharmaceutical career.
So you saw managing at that point as just a way of meeting other musicians?
Yeah, getting clients.
When did you start seeing yourself as seriously as just a manager?
People started getting arrested all around me, and I realized that was not the path I wanted to take. And the only thing in my life that was other than that was working with Alice as a manager. And said, let's go for it. And the band agreed, and we all put our heads down and tried to make it happen.
I'm speaking with Shep Gordon, who's written a memoir called They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll, published by Echo. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, on paper, you seem like just a regular kid from Long Island. Your father was in the shmata, the garment business. You went to SUNY Buffalo. But even before you went to Hollywood, you had done some illegal things that would have led you to the drug trade?
Yeah, it was the 60s. It was a different time, both in terms of engagement. We were all politically engaged, and in terms of no boundaries, and it was the beginning of free love and drugs, and it just seemed like the path to take, and I smoked my first marijuana in college and decided that this was something I wanted to spread.
So you were going to Mexico and bringing stuff back?
Went to Mexico.
And didn't you have to travel by horse across the Rio Grande?
I went down to Mexico very naive, and someone had told me about a guy that I could talk to, and I spoke to him. He said, meet me in Laredo. So I met him in the American side of Laredo, took a leap of faith. We walked across the bridge into a bar. I gave the guy some money. Next thing I knew, I was at a farm on a horseback. I had never ridden a horse before in my life. And I said, what am I doing? He said, the horse will take you, knows exactly what to do. And it walked across the Rio Grande. It was there was very little water.
So you're not the first person to have smuggled marijuana across the Rio Grande on that horse.
Yes, for sure.
Did you do that again?
I did it one more time, and I got away with it, but it was scary because when we got across the river, I brought a friend of mine that year who now is a doctor, I believe, and the car was surrounded by police, and we had to wait a few hours till they weren't there for us, it turned out. We were lucky. But
you say you got your first lesson about PR from a prank that you pulled when you were still in college. What happened?
Yeah, it was when I look back, I realize how lucky my life has been because this event sort of set up what I did for a living, how I translated my college years into Alice. We were in those days, you would stay up for days taking black beauties, they were called. It was a methadrine, like a speed to take tests. And every college kid stayed up, and you'd get out of your mind, just wacky. You'd be up for 2 days. And we were studying for a biology test, and one of the answers to a question was the thallus of Marchantia, which was the sex organ of a fern. And one thing led to another. We just thought it was hysterical, that it sounded like the ruler of a country. I wonder if the Buffalo mayor would ever believe, could we pull a prank? And somebody called a friend who went to the UN and sent a Western Union telegram to the mayor of Buffalo that the thallus of Marchantia was going to do his first visit to America. And we all thought it was over. The next day, it's the front page of the Buffalo Evening News that the thallus of Arcadia is visiting, that the mayor is going to meet him at the airport.
Some of the people who read that must have known that this was a practical
joke. I don't
know.
We were a small group.
There were botanists out there.
Maybe got it, but it's very obscure. And so we sent a kid down, Artie Shine, to New York because we figured now we have to have somebody come and get off the airplane. We gave him the sheets from the bed and pillowcases to wrap himself up. So he goes to New York. Now we're still up. Now it's the third day we're up, and we're getting crazier and crazier. And one of us, I don't remember who, it could have been me, maybe Joe Greenberg, my partner, came up with that, said, let's call the B'nai B'rith and tell them that the thallus is anti-Semitic and get them to go out to the airport and picket. And about 500 people showed up at the airport picketing. And as the mayor swooped them into the car, on the news came a thing that someone in the news department had realized what the thallus of Arcadia was. And instead of going to the hotel, they went to the jail. But that was my first time of realizing you could create history. And it was a lesson that really made my career possible.
You applied some
I applied that to
Alice Cooper. What did careers. You do there?
Well, it was the same theory. I applied it to all my acts. Rather than wait for something to happen to do it, to find who they were, I created events. So in the case of Alice Cooper, we wanted parents to hate him. That was our goal.
If parents hated them, then the kids might like them more.
Easier than writing a hit song. None of us knew how to write a hit song, but we knew how to get parents to hate us. And so we did the chicken story. Five guys named Alice in dresses. Not a thing parents were really into in 69. We put him in clear plastic clothes to try and get him arrested for indecent exposure. Unfortunately, the clothes fogged up.
But was he already wearing the eye makeup when you met him?
He just sort of started, just beginning. They had just taken on the name Alice Cooper. There was another group. They were called the Naz. There was another group. So they had to change it, and they wanted the most American name they could find.
And then came the chicken thing.
And then came the chicken. We didn't have money, but we liked to do stuff that was dramatic. So one of the first thing that we did was a feather pillow to end the show every night, because in the lights, the feathers looked beautiful. So chickens were somewhere in our brains. And
of course, The Who had already been smashing their guitars at this point.
Yeah, anything that was rebellious was good for us. I was doing a festival with John Lennon, with the Yoko Ono band in Toronto, and had gotten Alice to go on right before them, and was looking for something to do that would be really obnoxious, that people would talk about. And backstage were these feral chickens running around. So I took the chicken, threw it up on stage right into Alice, didn't tell him because I didn't know I was going to do it. And he picked it up and threw it in the audience thinking it could fly. It couldn't fly. It didn't have a good ending that day. But the next day the newspaper said, Alice bites the head of a chicken off and sucks the blood, which he didn't do. But that's what made the career. Mm. That one moment was what really made the career. Everything changed from that moment on.
Well, somebody else, a man named Osmond, had bitten off the head of...
That came much later.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
probably inspired by that? Yeah. Ozzy Osbourne?
Yeah. Much later.
Do you think it was inspired by...
Oh, yeah. I think it's all been, you know, I remember taking Groucho Marx to see Alice, and Alice got guillotined, and we thought we were the most creative people in the entire world, and Alice came off stage, and Groucho said, oh, yeah, Harry Dimson in 1929 did it in Chicago. There's nothing new. You know, I see Lady Gaga's meat jacket, and Alice had a rat jacket. Or I see Janet Jackson's dress fall off, and Raquel Welch's dress fall off. It's you repeat history.
Wasn't it also your idea to package the School's Out album in women's underwear?
Yeah, that was a wonderful moment. In those days, albums were important and packaging was important because you could tell your story. It wasn't just a song. You could actually tell a story. And a brilliant company had come up with this idea of a school desk for School's Out. And a desk that opened up, we were saying, what could you put in that school desk that parents would find really disgusting? And I had read this story 3 or 4 months before about customs confiscating flammable panties in Baltimore, and I thought it was hysterical. It just stuck in my mind. So when I saw the school desk, I said, oh, if that album was wrapped in panties and those panties got busted at customs, what a great story for parents to sell the album. But I didn't tell anybody about the flammable. So I got Warner's to do it. It wasn't easy, but we shipped 1 million albums because Alice was at the top of his game. I bought 3,000 pairs and shipped them to Baltimore. I called a reporter named Tom Zito, who worked at the Washington Post, tipped off customs, and the front page story was the largest panty raid in history in the Washington Post.
And how did it do in terms of selling albums?
I think we sold, I think it was the biggest album on Warner Brothers that year, maybe 2.5 million.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk a bit more about Alice and Groucho and Raquel Welch and all sorts of other things, Salvador Dali.
Great.
Let's see what we can get to. My guest is Shep Gordon, who has written a memoir called They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll. It's published by Echo in the Anthony Bourdain book imprint. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Shep Gordon, who is a talent manager, film agent, producer, who's worked with a wide range of stars, including Alice Cooper, Groucho Marx, Blondie, Raquel Welch. He has written a memoir, They Call Me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll. It is published by Echo in the Anthony Bourdain imprint. And we mentioned Raquel Welch. You were making Alice Cooper famous, but you're also making yourself famous in a way, or infamous?
I guess, yeah. It's a new turn of the page for me.
She asked you if you were the young man who made that freak Alice Cooper famous.
Yeah, that was a
famous. You didn't think that you would be scaring people away?
I didn't know. I didn't really care. But I at first didn't believe it was her. She called up, and, you know, I was 21 years old, maybe, Raquel Welch, oh, my God. And she said, exactly that, you the free? And I said, yes. And she said, I'm picking you up tomorrow. You're taking me to the Academy Awards. And I think I sweated from that moment till the awards were over. My armpits were just, I was so nervous. And when we got there, she leaned into me and said, "You got to hold my dress. The clip just broke." So now I'm holding the back of a chiffon dress with Raquel. But it was great. She was a great artist to work with.
What kind of publicity did you do for her?
Well, what I did is she came to me because she was an aging sex star. She knew that what was around the corner was not going to be productive for her.
Well, you could have let go of the dress and she would have gotten a lot of publicity.
Yeah, too cheap a shot. But what I did is put a song and dance act together for her. In those days, Ann Margaret was gigantic in Vegas. So we copied that. We just followed it.
And you mentioned Groucho Marx. Now, you met him through Alice. How did they become friends?
They became friends. Alice went to bed and got into bed with Groucho Marx to watch TV. It was wild. And he called me up next day and he said, "I watched television last night while Groucho was falling asleep."
They'd be wearing Mickey Mouse ears.
So he invited me over the next time, and I walked in, and they both were wearing Mickey Mouse ears, these gray Mickey Mouse ears that said Groucho on it.
And Groucho was very old at the time, and one of the great legends of American show business. Was there anything you could do for his career?
I got the TV show back on the air, which was about all I could do.
You Bet Your Life?
You Bet Your Life. They were all actors. 95% of the people on the show were SAG actors. So in order to get the show back on the air, we had to negotiate with all the actors.
And then you helped him afford night care.
That's what we did it for. He
didn't have very much money at this point?
He didn't have very much money. As business manager, in those days, nobody knew about Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And his business manager had it. And they just didn't know where the money was. It was really ridiculous. They found it eventually. But there was a period of 18 months or 2 years where they couldn't access the money because he couldn't remember where it was.
Didn't you help Alice commission a hologram of himself made by Salvador Dali?
Yeah. Salvador Dali was the inspiration of Alice and the band. They were all art students in Phoenix, and they put together a skit as a band. So if you think of Alice Cooper, for those of you that have seen him, and stop anywhere and make a still out of what you see, it's very Dali-esque, whether it's the guillotine, the chopping up the baby doll, the chicken on stage. The images are very Dali-esque. And we had been approached by someone about doing a hologram, and we said, let's see if Salvador Dali would do it.
And he did.
And he did.
All of this sounds like a lot of fun, but you say there was a flip side to all of the success, that the more famous your friends and clients got, the more damage seemed, your fame seemed to damage them, or did you feel responsibility for what
I
you
felt,
did?
I felt some responsibility. I was very honest with everybody I worked with. Before I would sign them, I would say, if I do my job perfectly, I may kill you. And I meant it seriously.
But weren't you concerned? I mean, so many people were dying at that time, Janis Joplin, mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, and others, all because of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah, but I think, when you're born, the only thing you know for sure is you're going to die. That's it.
Yeah, but not at 27.
Don't want to die at 27, but if you want to live your dreams and you're aware of what you're doing and this is the path you want to take and people are honest with you, who am I to tell someone not to take it?
As a manager, one of the most important and often most difficult tasks is collecting the money at the end of the night. And you had struggled with that in the past. But when you started working with Teddy Pendergrass, you experienced something a little bit different.
Yeah.
Because you were working the Chitlin' Circuit?
Yeah. The Chitlin' Circuit was a name for a circuit of nightclubs and arenas that Afro-American artists worked, in conjunction with local radio stations, local black promoters, and the record company. And they weren't paid the same way white artists were.
Even though they were big stars.
Even though they were big stars, but they were very controlled. And Teddy's last manager had been shot to death, to give you an idea of the seriousness of this particular game.
And then you took on the gig?
I took on the gig and decided I didn't have much to lose and that this was really unfair. And I had always seen myself as a guy on a white horse riding in to save the day, just like with Janis. And I said to Teddy, "Hey, you want to give it a shot? We may not live, but at least, you know, we'll have tried to do something good.
And you said the same was true for Earth, Wind, and Fire and
they came
other
along,
top acts.
Yeah.
Were they being cheated by their record labels as well?
I don't know if it was cheated. It was part of the system. It's just the way the system went. The record companies in the Afro-American world treated their artists more like indentured servants. They sort of reinstituted the slavery system into the record company because that's what they knew. And it always takes generations for people to break out of things. So I think even though they were black-owned record companies, there was a universal way of treating blacks in America that fell into. It was no different than sitting at the back of the bus.
There was a story about a big star with Atlantic Records telling the owners that he was going to move over to Roulette for a much better deal. I think it was Wilson Pickett. And the guys at Atlantic said, okay, you'll have a better contract, but you won't get paid.
That's
you stay
sure.
with us, you'll get
yeah,
paid.
Yeah, yeah.
You and Teddy Pendergrass hatched a plot to turn everything around by booking a show at the Roxy. That was the big theater in Los Angeles?
Correct.
What happened?
We decided that we were going to try and break the Chitlin' Circuit. And the Roxy was a very, very white nightclub, so we booked the show there. We got death threats. The FBI ended up protecting us that night.
Death threats? Why? Because a black act was playing?
Yeah, why? Because we weren't playing.
A lot of black acts played the Fillmore East.
Not a lot. Ike and Tina Turner, there were a couple of acts, but they weren't acts that were in that world. Ike and Tina Turner was not in that world. They were signed to Mercury Records or someone, as I understand. But none of the serious ones. I mean, an Otis Redding may have been able to get a play or two in, but he was on Capricorn Records. But you look at the Marvin Gaye's of life, you look at, you know, those artists, the Spinners, all of them, they were playing in the circuit.
Even though they were with Motown.
Yeah.
You also worked with Luther Vandross.
Yep.
Did he have similar experiences?
No. By the time, after Teddy, it all opened up. Mm-hmm. We sort of broke through, but we, you know, we played Radio City Music Hall. We got picketed very heavily.
For what? We don't want black people playing
the
Radio City
Music
Hall?
They can't say it. They did it for other reasons, that the Radio City wasn't hiring enough black people or something. They went after Radio City. But they protected their territory strongly.
Then you got into the movie business, and pretty much with one of the most important figures in the business, Ridley Scott.
Yeah, that was my first movie. It was called The Duelist. And it was Ridley's first movie.
And it got great reviews at Cannes, but got much
It
play.
Never got released.
Do we know why?
Yeah, we do. We won the Cannes Film Festival, and we were young guys, his first movie, and we came back to present the movie to the studio, thinking that they're going to, you know, wow, we are like kings of the world. Oh, my God, they're going to give us a 10-picture deal. And there was a gentleman named David Picker, whose dad was very famous in the film business, was one of the founders of 20th Century Fox, I believe it was. And David gave us the money for the movie, and as we were flying back, we found out that he had been let go, and there were two new heads of the studio, Barry Diller and I can't remember the fellow from Disney, Michael Eisner.
Mm-hmm.
And we go in to show the movie, and the lights go dark, and they haven't even come in yet. And then we hear the door shut. About 10 minutes into the movie, the lights come back up. These two guys stand up in the back, Michael Eisner and Barry Diller. And Barry Diller says, "Hi, guys, I'm Barry Diller. I can be Michael Eisner. We just came from ABC Television. We took over the TV, and we don't like this arty stuff, so we're really not going to release it." And left the room. We never even shook hands.
And they lost an opportunity to release Ridley Scott's first film, based on a Chekhov novel, was it?
Yes, yeah.
Or Chekhov's
short
story.
No, it was a Joseph Conrad short story.
A Joseph Conrad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I knew it was one of those
Eastern Europeans.
Guys. Yeah. On top of your work in music and film, you're credited with helping invent the celebrity chef. You were all over the place.
Yeah, it's really the same thing. It just looks different from the outside.
What happened there?
I was mentored by a wonderful man, Mr. Roger Verger, who was the inventor of Nouveau Cuisine. And I was at a point, I met him at a point in my life where I was way too successful, way too in every category. I had the white Rolls Royce, the blow was going up my nose, women everywhere. It just was, and I was headed for a disaster just like everybody else. And in my life, it was all successful, miserable people, which is basically the entertainment business. And into the room, when I won the Cannes Film Festival in 77, came Mr. Verger. And he looked successful and happy, and I asked him if I could be his grasshopper, like in Kung Fu, and he let me. And through him, I got to meet the chefs of the world, see what great artists they were, and see how poorly they were treated. It was exactly the Chitlin circuit. So I had experience on how to organize and break through, almost like a union, and that's what I did. And it's been the proudest moment of my life.
One of the people you worked with, Emeril Lagasse, became famous not only for his food, but because he would say things like BAM on television.
Yeah, BAM came about. The Food Network, I had read that Reese Schoenfeld, who started CNN, was looking to do a new network. He hadn't decided what yet. And I got all the chefs to agree to work for free. And I went to Reese and I said, you know, if you do a food network, I can get you the talent free. The only thing we want is a commercial in each show. So Emeril was the first show he took. We needed to do something for the commercial. We made up the spices. The spices led to BAM, and the rest is sort of history.
And is this the reason that this book is published by Anthony Bourdain's new imprint? Because he's somebody who bridges the gap between rock and roll and food?
Well, he came up to me at, I had never met him, big fan.
There was a movie. Had he seen the film?
I don't know if he saw the film. I assume he did, but I'm a bit of a groupie still. And when he came, I was at a Roy Choi book signing in Brooklyn. And Anthony came up to me, and I was like, wow, that's Anthony Bourdain, man. I've always wanted to meet this guy. And he comes walking up to me, are you Shep Gordon? I said, yeah. And he said, I want to do a book with you. And I said, great, man, I'll do anything with you. And he said, you know, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, you made Emeril famous, and I got famous by beating up Emeril. So if you hadn't made him famous, I wouldn't be here tonight.
You also cooked a meal yourself for the Dalai Lama?
Yeah, I offered my services to cook for him after meeting him, and he accepted, so I cooked three different times for him.
Did you assume that he was a vegetarian?
I assumed he was a vegetarian, and the Tibetan people are so gentle that they won't really tell you. You know, whatever you cook is fine. And I worked really hard to research, and I found that yak was really the thing of Tibet. And
you cook yak?
I didn't cook the yak, but I got yak butter, which smelled up my whole house, made yak tea, and in my first morning I brought him breakfast and he was brushing his teeth, and I was so proud that I had yak tea. And I walk in, and he starts smelling, and he goes, yak tea. And I said, yes, Your Holiness, so proud. He said, oh, that's why I leave Tibet. And someone just sent me a picture of yak cheese on the cheese tray at La Bernardine 2 days ago, which I thought was fantastic. Eric is a Buddhist and beautiful. But no, he ate beef stew, spaghetti and meatballs. He was not a vegetarian at all.
And I mentioned the documentary a couple of years ago made by Mike Myers.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah.
You've retired?
I have. Basically, I still do Alice Cooper.
Why did you retire? You moved to Hawaii. And
I've been in Hawaii a lot of years.
You're out of the loop for now?
Yeah, I had a moment. I've lived in Hawaii for 40 years, but I about maybe 12 or 13 years ago, I had a premiere in L.A., and big red carpet premiere. I was really bored to death. Couldn't wait to get home and just get in bed and watch CNN. And next day came to Hawaii and was alone on my hammock watching sunset, and every molecule in my body was ecstatic. And I said, well, what's it all about? And the next week I just came in and resigned from all my clients and have been in Maui happily ever since.
But you say still representing Alice.
Alice, still represent Alice.
Although he's not doing a lot these days.
He does 150 dates a year.
Really?
Yeah. My new definition of retirement is you do exactly the same thing, you don't get paid.
They call me Supermensch, a backstage pass to the amazing worlds of film, food, and rock and roll, is Shep Gordon's memoir, published by the Anthony Bourdain book imprint of Echo. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Great to see you again.